You're all guinea pigs this evening. This is the experimental approach to Sunday evenings at Hebron. So we'll see what happens. So what we want to talk about tonight is the idea of the tension that is perceived to exist between science on the one hand and Christianity, or any faith really, on the other side. We want to see if this is a genuine problem or whether it's something that can actually synergize, if Christianity can actually be greatly substantiated and supported by what science has to say. And the first thing is that a lot of people talk about God of the gaps, and this is an accusation that's often made against Christians. So they'll say, you use God to explain that which science can't explain. And already when people do that, they're setting up a completely false dichotomy, as if it's one or the other. It isn't the case. And actually, it's the bits of science that we understand best that give us the greatest evidence for the work of God in creation. It's not the bits we don't understand. So it's not as if science is progressively accumulating more and more knowledge, and the bit left for God to explain gets smaller and smaller and smaller as science explains more and more and more. It's the exact opposite of that. The more science we understand, the more we can see evidence for design in creation. And this is in Romans chapter 1, isn't it? For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, divine nature have been, what's the word? Clearly. This is not hidden. What's the word? Clearly seen. Being understood from what has been made, so people are without excuse. So the very first verse, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now this means, according to Christian theology, that there was a beginning. There was a beginning. And this has been greatly resisted by many cosmological thinkers. Fred Hoyle was the classic one who didn't like this idea. He was in Manchester University, he had a house in the Lake District. And he said, what are you saying? That everything began in some big bang? And he used this as a derogatory term. So it's Fred Hoyle that actually came up with that idea, because he didn't like the idea of the beginning. But anyone who's read the New Testament since the days, Old Testament since the days of Moses, has read in the beginning. There was a beginning. That means there was a time when there was no time, a time when there was no space, a time when there was no matter, a time when the universe that we understand didn't exist. And then at one finite point in time, not that long ago, it spontaneously came into existence. Now, things don't happen without a cause. So given that the universe had a beginning, it follows that there must be some cause of the universe. And given that there was no universe when the universe was caused, that means the cause of the universe must be external to the universe itself. It cannot be part of the universe. And we know that God is outside of the universe. The universe is something that he created. So God created the heavens and the earth. Now the heavens can mean different things in different contexts, but one of the things that heavens means is the stars, what we see out there. And Brian Cox keeps changing his mind about this. He used to say there was 150,000 million stars in the galaxy. Then for a while he said there's 200,000 million. Now he's been saying there's 200,000 to 300,000 million stars in the galaxy. Anyway, it's a lot. Right? If you had to pay a pound each, you'd be a bit strapped. So 200,000 million. Right? That's two American billion, isn't it? Is it? Anyway, 200,000 million stars. And that's the Andromeda galaxy as seen through the Hubble Space Telescope. It's 2 million light years away. It's approaching us quite quickly, actually. If you're around in about 3 billion years' time, it'll be huge in the sky. In 3.5 billion years' time, it'll collide with us and we'll interact. And I'm not too worried about it, but it is approaching us. at quite a rapid rate. And the astronomers that control the Hubble Space Telescope, a few years ago, they picked the blankest bit of sky they could look at and did a time exposure over several nights. And this is what they came up with. And the blankest bit of sky was full of galaxies. So these are all galaxies. And they can contain 200,000 million stars each. This is the scale of the universe. But it's finite. It only started a finite time ago. And it is finite. Although by our standards, quite unimaginably large. God has created these heavens. God created the heavens and the earth. And this is one of the Apollo shops of the earth where we live. And as we'll see, it's quite an interesting place. But you knew that already. Now, given that God created the universe, will any old sort of universe do? Can you just kind of chuck anything into the mix and hope for the best and you'll probably get people out of it? Well, it turns out quite a few things need to be right to support human life. So we need the right physics, and we need the right cosmos, and we need the right galaxy, and we need the right sun. And we certainly need the right solar system. We need the right Earth. Oh, we need you as well, by the way, because you are conscious of it, aren't you? This is all about you being conscious of this. And we need it to be at the right time as well. So quite a few things have got to be right for this to work. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So we need the right physics. Any physicists here? Good, that means I can make up the bits I don't know. Good. The creation had to contain exactly the right proportion of electrons and protons. Because as you probably know, electrons are negative and protons are positive. And if you've got too many negatives, they repel and you don't get viable matter. If you get too many positive protons, they repel and you don't get viable matter. So more of any one means that these forces, these electromagnetic forces, generated by the positive protons and negative electrons, that means that the repulsive forces would overcome gravity and you wouldn't get stars. So there needs to be the right proportion of positive and negative particles in the cosmos. And of course, we have a cosmos, there is the right proportion. Now, right at the heart of any atom, you have a group of protons all together. Apart from a hydrogen atom, when you only have one proton. And of course, protons are positive, aren't they? They are, trust me. Right? And what do two positives do if they're close together? They repel. So we need an additional force. And the additional force is called the strong nuclear force. So when two protons get really, really close together, they link up. And they're connected by the strong nuclear force. And the strong nuclear force overcomes the electromagnetic repulsive forces that normally tries to force them apart. And Martin Rees, the astronomer, ex-astronomer royal, says that if the strong nuclear force was 2% weaker or 0.3% stronger, it wouldn't work. If it was weaker, you wouldn't get heavy elements. You wouldn't get elements with lots of protons all together in the nucleus because the force would be too weak to hold them together. And you wouldn't get elements heavier than hydrogen or possibly helium. And if it was stronger, that means once the strong nuclear force had held two particles together, they'd never come apart again. And we wouldn't have chemistry. And we wouldn't have free hydrogen, which we need. So it must be exactly right, 2% weaker or 0.3% stronger, and there would be no matter to make us of. There would be no matter. We couldn't exist. The Earth couldn't exist. Stars couldn't exist. And the force of gravity has to be just right as well. This has to be finely tuned. Now, if the force of gravity was stronger, stars would be more dense, and their burning time would be increased. Sorry, the intensity would be increased, their burning time would be shortened. if they were all crammed together. So stars would burn up too quickly. But weaker, and stars would not become hot enough to ignite nuclear fusion. And nuclear fusion is the process that goes on within stars where lighter elements fuse together to form the heavier elements. This is how heavier elements are formed. So initially, the universe only contained hydrogen and helium. The heavier elements, for example, the iron in your red blood cells, was fused together inside stars. This is how heavier elements were developed. So if the force of gravity was weaker, those nuclear fusion processes would not take place, and again, we would have no matter. Stable stars are needed for planets. So our star is just the right size because all the elements are held together by just the right amount of gravity. So we need a stable star to have a planet around, but to have the material to have a planet in the first place, you have to have had previous generations of stars to facilitate that process of nuclear fusion to make the heavier elements. And the fine-tuning involved here turns out to be exquisite. The strong nuclear force is what holds the subatomic particles together within the nucleus. The electromagnetic force is what tends to throw them apart. So what we see there is an atom, and that tiny incy-wincy bit inside is the nucleus. And the ratio for atoms to work between the strong nuclear force holding them together and the electromagnetic repulsive forces pushing them apart has been calculated by quite a few leading physicists, for example, Paul Davis, as being in 1 part in 10 to the 16. The ratio between those forces must be fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 16. That's 1 part in 1 with 16 noughts after it, which is a big number. Someone offers you those chances on the lottery, don't take them. You won't win. So we need just the right size stars. So we said that the right size stars are needed to produce the elements. Only small stars burn long enough to have stable planets, like ours. So our star is relatively small. Star size depends on the ratio of electromagnetic forces to gravity. So not only does the electromagnetic force and the strong nuclear force need to be fine-tuned, their ratio, we also need finely tuned relationships between the electromagnetic forces and gravity. So the electromagnetic forces are going to tend to hold a star together. No, gravity is going to hold it together. The electromagnetic repulsive forces are going to tend to push it apart. And to get stars, to get the heavy elements, those two forces have to be fine-tuned. And they have to be fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 40th. Otherwise, you don't get stars. Right? You just don't get stars. If you increase it by 1 part in 10 to the 40th, that would mean only small stars. And if you decrease it, that means you'd only get large stars because of the combination of the gravitational and the electromagnetic forces. So not only do these two forces, as determined by laws of physics, have to be right, the ratio between them has to be exactly right as well, in parts of 1 part in 10 to the 40th. What the heck does that mean? Well, that's 10 to the 40 there. That's one with 40 noughts after it. So, you could take the American continent or the European continent, cover Europe with 10 p pieces, because they're quite small now, aren't they? I don't normally use cash that much, but I was amazed how small 10 p pieces are these days. Tiny little things. So cover the United States of America or Europe with 10p pieces. and make a column of those 10 P pieces, that's 236,000 miles high. That's the column that goes from here to the moon. The moon is 236,000 miles away. Would that give you 10 to the 40 10p pieces? No. You would have to do that a billion times. That's what 10 to the 40 is. So get 10p pieces if you can afford it. Cover Europe in a column all the way up to the moon without it falling over. Do the same on a billion other continents, and then paint one of them 10p pieces red. And give your wife a blindfold and tell her to pick the red coin. That's what 1 in 10 to the 40 is. It's reasonable to include, or to conclude, that it is improbable that such fine-tuning of cosmological forces would spontaneously arise. Now, I'm sure you all know that the universe is getting bigger. It's expanding. In fact, it now looks like the acceleration rate of the cosmos is increasing. Now, if the expansion rate was faster, matter disappears, or sort of blows out, disperses, before galaxies form. So if the expansion rate is too fast, you don't have the gravitational forces overcoming the expansion momentum to form galaxies. But if it's slower, then matter would clump together, and all the universe would form one super dense clump. Because as the universe started to expand, gravity would overcome it. And it turns out, if you look at the initial conditions that were required to facilitate this speed of cosmic expansion, that the initial conditions had to determine the expansion rate to be accurate to 1 part in 10 to the 55. So the expansion rate of the cosmos needs to be fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 55. So that's even more piles of 10p pieces, isn't it? 1 part in 10 to the 55 to get the correct expansion rate of the cosmos, to get the correct galaxy, to have us in. This is what you need. And the other interesting thing is, it might be more of a philosophical point, but we are at just the right time. We could not have been here in the past, because young universes don't have enough heavy elements from intrastellar fusional processes. There hasn't been enough heavy elements produced. But older universes, stars are no longer in stable burning phases. So human life has not been possible in the past. Human life will not be possible in the future. This is a special time. And right now, you are conscious in that special time. Anyway, we could talk about physics till the cows come home. But let's conclude by the physics part by talking about Fred Hoyle again. Now, Fred Hoyle was working out how carbon atoms were formed inside stars. And he worked out that carbon atoms were formed by the fusion of usually by three helium atoms. And the energies in these atoms had to be exactly finely controlled, or you wouldn't get a carbon atom. And he concluded this. Which is good. I mean, Fred Hoyle was a true scientist because he was an atheist. And that's what he concluded. Super intellect monkeying with the laws of physics. Imagine that. Right, just right Earth. The Earth has to be just right. Earth is a bit of a special place. Was the porridge just too hot? Or was it just too cold? Or was it just right? The Goldilocks principle. The Earth is just the right distance from the sun. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. And we've got a 2% latitude in this. So human life might be possible if we were 1% nearer the sun. But it would get pretty hot in summer. And parts of the planet would be uninhabitable. And the same if it was 1% further away. It would be pretty cold in winter, and parts of the planet would be uninhabitable. We just so happen to be in just the right place, or we are designed to be in just the right place, depending on your worldview. Now, the Earth's got a magnetic field. Don't use it much these days with GPS, do we? But it's got a magnetic field. And the Earth's magnetic field is generated by currents in the Earth's iron core. We know the Earth has an iron core, even though it's a couple of thousand miles down there, because if there's an earthquake in Hawaii, we can tell by the way the Earth wobbles in Scotland, by these waves that go through the Earth and other waves that go around the surface of the Earth. So currents in the Earth's magnetic core generate the magnetic field. Because the iron core is molten and it moves, it generates currents. And the Earth's magnetic field actually wobbles a little bit, moves around a bit. And from time to time it actually flips and reverses. So the North Pole becomes the South Pole and the South Pole becomes the North Pole. It hasn't done that for a while, but it does do it from time to time. So, to get the Earth's magnetic field, we need the right amount of iron. And the iron has to be at the correct position in the centre of the Earth. It's not the iron in the iron ore mines that give you rise to the magnetic field. It's the iron at the centre of the Earth. And there needs to be the right amount of currents in the core to generate the Earth's magnetic field. And the magnetic field has to extend out into space quite a long way. There needs to be a magnetosphere of the right intensity surrounding the Earth, in the same way as a magnetosphere surrounds a magnet. And that is important because all the time the sun is giving off solar winds and cosmic rays. And these are actually ionized, charged particles that are given off from the sun. And they travel fast, 500, 600, 700 kilometers per second. Now, if these charged particles hit you, they'll penetrate you quite substantially and give you cancer, which wouldn't be good. But also, the ionized particles from the solar wind would ionize water and physically sweep it away from the Earth. The water in the upper atmosphere would be swept out into space with the solar wind, as indeed would a lot of the oxygen molecules. And it's believed that this is why Venus and Mercury have essentially no atmosphere, because it's all been swept away by the solar winds, and indeed Mars has very, very light atmosphere, because it's been swept away. But because the solar winds are charged particles, they're deflected by the Earth's magnetic field. That's of course why you get the aurora, isn't it? The ionized energetic particles in the upper atmosphere giving the aurora borealis in the north. So without the magnetic field, we would not exist. It's that simple. The Earth would not be a habitable place if the Earth did not have a magnetic field. So that's indeed fortuitous as well. And then we need just the right moon. The moon is absolutely essential for advanced life on Earth. The moon's got to be the right mass, and it's got to be just the right distance from the Earth, although it is getting further away all the time. Obviously, tides and light at night, but the Earth stabilizes the Earth's axis. If we didn't have the moon in space as a counterbalance to the Earth's axis would wobble. In fact, people think Venus has probably wobbled so much it's completely upside down. And Venus is not the sort of place you'd want to live. Far too hot. So it stabilizes the tilt of the Earth. Now, the moon's distance to provide this stability turns out it has to be just the right distance from the Earth. If it was closer, we'd have massive tides, and Carlisle would be in the tidal zone. And as well as that, you would get tidal bulges in the land, which would cause volcanism and earthquakes and all sorts of stuff. If it was further away, you'd get less tides, and there'd be less stability in the rotational axis. So the seasons would be all to pot, and we wouldn't be able to plan on agriculture, because we couldn't anticipate the seasons. And the Earth is spinning, but the rotational rate at which the Earth is spinning is slowed by the Moon. Now, if the Earth was spinning faster, we'd have very short days. You'd have to get up even earlier in the morning. But of course, if it was spinning too slowly, then it would get hot in the day and cold at night, wouldn't it? The temperature is balanced out between day and night because of the speed at which the Earth rotates. And it turns out to be just right to maintain equilibrium of ocean temperatures. And it's the equilibrium of ocean temperatures that maintains the equilibrium of our weather. This is why we're so worried about the Gulf Stream going wrong, because it's the warm oceans that keeps us warm in winter. Otherwise it would be even colder than it is now. And not only does the distance of the Moon from the Earth have to be right, but the mass of the Moon has to be right as well. More massive Moon, Earth's axis would wobble, and the Earth would also be turning much more slowly because of the Moon's gravitational drag on the Earth. And that will give you awful long hot days and awful long cold nights. Less massive Moon, the Earth's rotation would be faster and the days would be shorter, but would also have hurricanes all the time, because the amount of winds on the surface of the planet is determined partly by the rotational speed of that planet. So planets where the surface is spinning quite fast, like Jupiter, you get 2,000 miles an hour wind, which would blow off my motorbike, no problem at all. It's due to different rates of friction between the atmosphere and the geosphere of a planet. So if the Moon was not there, the Earth would be spinning quicker and it would be far too windy. And also the rotation rate of the Earth determines the magnetic field that we've already talked about. Now, the current theory in solar system formation is that the Moon was formed shortly after the formation of the Earth when a collider bumped into us. And the evidence for this is fairly convincing. For example, the isotopic signatures of rocks on the Moon and those on the Earth are exactly the same. The Earth and the Moon are made of exactly the same material. And if this collider did indeed collide with the Earth, it had to be just the right mass, and it had to be at just the right angle, because a lesser impact, this impact on gravity, would have reformed all the material that formed the Earth, all the material that formed the Moon, rather, onto the Earth. And if that happened, we'd have a supermassive Earth, but no Moon, which means we'd be even heavier than I am now, because the Earth would have more gravity. We would have no Moon, so we wouldn't have the stability of the rotational axis. We wouldn't have agriculture. So Moon is absolutely fundamental to the whole system. 23.5 degrees. Seasons, agriculture, predictability, all provided by the presence of the Moon. And it looks nice as well. Now, the Earth was formless and empty at one time. Did you know that? Darkness was over the surface of the deep. That's the NIV for it. You should say the Earth was formless and void, shouldn't it? But I guess it means the same thing. The Spirit of God was over the waters. So at one time, I think this is might not be taking too much from this to think that the Earth was covered in water at one time. the Spirit of God was over the surface of the deep, when the earth, at the time when the earth was formless and void. But it's been estimated that if there was no land sticking up above the sea, we'd have an atmosphere around the earth, followed by 200 metres of water, followed by the land underneath. That means we'd all have wet feet at this time, because there'd be 200 metres of water above us, or a lot of water above us. Now, the reason that we have land is because of tectonic processes. And we can see this happening in Iceland, can't we? You know, there's new land coming up, and we can see it happening in Hawaii. And the Himalayas are actually getting higher. People have measured the Himalayas last year, and this year, you know, they're a bit higher. They've gone up a bit because of the tectonic plate, the Indian tectonic plate crashing into the Eurasian tectonic plate. And you can actually measure the change in differences, the height of the Himalayas from year to year, certainly decade by decade. And what is it that generates these tectonic processes? Well, it is liquidity and semi-liquidity and viscosity in the rocks, in the deeper part of the Earth's core and the top part of the Earth's mantle. It's fluid down there to some extent. And it's fluid because the rocks are semi-molten. Now, why are the rocks semi-molten? Because they're very, very hot. Why are they hot? Because there's radioactive decay going on in those rocks. And the radioactive decay comes primarily from two sources, both based on uranium. So there's uranium-235. That means it's got 235 neutrons in its nucleus. Now, it means it's got half that many neutrons in its nucleus. That's the overall nuclear mass, 235. Some would be protons, half would be protons, roughly. And the other type is uranium-238, with a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Now, what the Iranians are trying to do at the moment is purify the more fissile form, which is the uranium-235. This is what they're trying to do. We did it way back in the Manhattan Project and in Sellafield for, or Windscale, for many, many years. We took the raw uranium and we tried to extract the uranium-235, which is the fissile grade. And the right combination of these two half-lives, emitting radiation out into the adjacent rocks, heats them up to just the right amount. Now, if it heated them more and the rocks were too liquid, we'd have more geology. That means more volcanoes, more earthquakes, more geology. Not geology. Yeah, geology. More geology. That's right. And if it didn't heat them enough, we would get less geology. That means less land sticking out of the sea. So it heats them to just the right amount, so we have the correct ratio of land and sea on the surface of the Earth. And that's necessary for lots of different environmental reasons, to have the right relationship between land and sea. So it just so happened that when the Earth was formed, it had exactly the right amount of uranium-235 and exactly the right amount of uranium-238 to give us exactly the amount of geology that we have now. Or it was designed that way, depending on your worldview. Earth's surface temperature obviously must be right. We don't like being hot, we don't like being cold. And the sun's luminosity has actually increased by 35% since life first appeared on Earth. And that was counterbalanced by the reduction in greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane. So the reduction in the amounts of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere had to be proportionately balanced over geological time to maintain an equilibrium of temperature on the surface of the Earth. And the Earth's surface temperature has remained stable, so it's been able to support life throughout that time. Now, Hugh Roth has calculated that all the things that need to be right about the Earth, and he's calculated very conservatively, Hugh Roth is an American astrophysicist, that the chances of such a planet existing are 1 chance in 10 to the 30th. And given that there's only probably 1 to the 23 stars in the cosmos, it's phenomenally unlikely that a planet such as Earth would exist in the cosmos had it not been intended to exist. And not only that, we've got just the right viewing point. We're not in the middle of a galaxy, so we can see out, we can see all of the other galaxies, we can see our galaxy. And in fact, it's even more convenient than that. It just so happens that the moon is just the right size in the sky as the sun, so you can get a total eclipse. And the fact that you can get a total eclipse means that we're able to confirm, for example, that light is bent by gravity in that famous experiment by, what's his name, who confirmed Einstein. What was his name? English physicist. Anyway. And we've also learnt about the composition of the sun and things like that. As a result of that observation, we've got a very good time and a very good viewing platform with which we can view the universe so it can become intelligible. And not only have we got the right Earth, we've got the right amount of other planets. Now, I don't know what the number is. It's probably about 300-400 now exoplanets have been discovered. We now know with certainty that there are planets orbiting other stars. But these appear to be gas giant planets, and they appear to orbit their star very closely. Whereas our gas giants orbit way out. What's this one?
Jupiter.
Jupiter. Go by the red spot, can't you? And that's one of its moons going over the surface. Now, if there was no Jupiter, remember a few years ago that Hale-Bopp, was it Hale-Bopp, bumped into Jupiter? Remember those pictures of that thing going into Jupiter? So the gravitational attraction of Jupiter mops up a lot of these things that would otherwise bump into us. But the gravitational force of Jupiter also knocks a few things out of orbit that do bump into us. And a lot of people think that all Earth's water arrived on meteorites that were bumped out of orbit by Jupiter. The recent evidence shows that water probably did not come from comets. So Jupiter's been quite useful for various things. It's not there by accident. We need the right sort of galaxy. A lot of galaxies are elliptical galaxies. And these are made mostly of old stars with sparse interstellar medium. That means they've got low amounts of heavy elements to make planets and to make people. So if you want to try and find other life, an elliptical galaxy is not a good place to go look. And other galaxies are called irregular galaxies. And these are dense with very active cores. And it's believed that these have supermassive black holes at their centre. And supermassive black holes with solar masses of several million solar masses will bounce stars around as easily as ping pong balls. And of course, stars that are being bounced around will not support life-supporting planets. They also have very high radiation levels because of all the stellar activity that's going on. And they also have low metallicity. That means they have not produced the heavy elements required to produce planets and to produce the iron that is in your red blood cells. Milky Way galaxy, where we live, is probably looked like that. It's called a bar spiral galaxy. And we live way out in the suburbs. We live on a spiral arm. That's why you can see the Milky Way at night. You can look towards the galactic centre and you can see the Milky Way at night. So spiral arms are peaceful places because the stellar mass is not too high. Therefore, the gravitational interaction between stars is not going to bounce our planet around too much. Just the right stellar density. But they're high in heavy elements from old supernovae. So in the past, supernovae have exploded. As a result of the fusional processes that went on in their cores, heavy elements have been dispersed out into space to form planets and to form you. But fortunately, there's few current supernovas going on because they would completely frizzle us to pieces with massive ejections of radiation. We would not survive an adjacent supernova event. And there's various other interesting elements that we won't go into. Star has to be right. That's the sun, has to be just right. Must be a single system, not a binary, because the gravitational interactions would mess up planetary orbits. Can't be too massive, because that would burn too quickly and erratically. So if you're orbiting a massive star, the amount of radiation given out by that star would vary from week to week. And on a planet as far away from the sun as ours is, that could be the difference of 100 degrees centigrade, or you know, silly amounts, completely incompatible with life. Less massive, and the habitable zone, so if it's less massive, the star would be cooler, and the habitable zone would be much closer to the star. Now that's good because you get more radiation, but it's bad because you're going to get much more gravity because you're closer to the star, and gravity obeys the inverse square law. So if you're twice as near to the star, you get the squared amount of gravity. And that would probably mean that the planet would be tidally locked into the star. So have you ever noticed that the moon always shows the same face? We never see the dark side of the moon, do we? Never. That's because the moon is gravitationally locked to the Earth. As the Earth turns, the same face of the moon is gravitationally locked to the Earth. So we only see the same face of the moon. And if a planet was close to a more massive star, the same thing would happen. The planet would become gravitationally locked, with all sorts of complications. I'm getting on to the bit I actually know something about now, life. Building blocks for life and simple molecules on the Earth. Now we need protein, and proteins are made of hundreds of amino acids. So in a protein, it's a macromolecule, it's made of a string of hundreds of amino acids, sometimes 1,000 or more. And amino acids have two forms. They have right-handed form and they have left-handed form. And the proteins in you are all made up of left-handed amino acids. So they need to be the left-handed form. As well as that, as we were reminded this morning, you need some deoxyribonucleic acid. And you need some ribonucleic acid. And all of these have hundreds of these ATCG, adenine, cytosine, thymine, guanine base pairs. So there's a lot of complexity there. Now, prokaryotic cells are simple bacterial cells. Now, when I say simple, compared to your cells, these really are simple. Compared to your cells, the cells in your body are described as eukaryotic cells, and they are so much more complicated than bacteria. But let's think about the very simplest form of self-perpetuating life. The very simplest bacterial organism, the simplest prokaryotic organism, needs about 400 genes. That is 400 units of genetic information. And it needs 400 proteins to form the structure of the bacterial cell that are made by those genes. So that's the minimum, and that's heterotrophic. This won't be capable of photosynthesis. It would have to have a food source or readily available. And one gene is at least 1,000 base pairs of these A, T, Cs and Gs. And each protein has hundreds of amino acids, or even thousands of amino acids in its sequence. So how likely is it that these things just spontaneously occurred? Well, if we take a small little protein of 100 amino acids, they all need to be in the L form. So if you had a prebiotic soup situation, which may or may not have existed, but if you had that situation, these form equal number of left and right-handed amino acids. Are the right-handed ones any good? No, completely useless. We need the left-handed ones. And the chances of getting a right or a left-handed one at any one point are 50-50. And 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5, 100 times, means that the chances of getting 100 L-type amino acids all at the same time are 1 chance in 10 to the 30. That's one with 30 noughts after it. And all the amino acids need to have peptide bonds. So again, in prebiotic situations, some of the bonds between amino acids would be peptide bonds, others would be different types of bonds. And the probability, again, of getting a peptide bond or a non-peptide bond is about 50%. So again, it's 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5. So to get your 100 L-type amino acids, 1 in 10 to the 30, to get your amino acids, all with peptide bonds, another 1 in 10 to the 30th. That means the chances of getting this single 100 unit protein right is 1 chance in 10 to the 60th, which becomes ludicrous. And also, each letter needs to be in the correct order to make the protein chain functional. So it's not any 100 amino acids, it's got to be the right ones. Now, normally your DNA and your RNA sorts all this out for you because you have a already existing cell. But if you're in a prebiotic situation, you don't have that luxury. And there's 20 amino acids, 20 different amino acids in your body. The totality of your proteome is made up of 20 different amino acids, that's all. And the chances of getting the right one in 20, every one of the 100 points in this short protein, would be a 20th times a 20th times a 20th. If you do that 100 times, the probability of getting the correct amino acids to form a functional protein, which is the only sort that will do for life. Non-functional proteins are no good because they don't function. The chances of that are 1 chance in 10 to the 130th. It's numbers we can't imagine. Oh, and after that we'd need a cell as well. That would be one protein. In a cell there's thousands of proteins. So the probability of life coming spontaneously into existence appear to be essentially nil. And that's without telling you the story at all about the deoxyribonucleic acid and the ribonucleic acid. We had that this morning, so we're fully up to speed on that. But if we do the calculations on forming the genes required to control the proteome, we find that is equally unlikely to spontaneously form. And remember, we would need the 400 proteins and the 400 genes to form at the same time in the same place. This is getting a bit tricky, isn't it? I haven't got time to do this slide, but it's fascinating that all the life is the same. Right, top left is what? What do you call sausage-shaped bacteria? Come on, someone knows this. Gail, not to pick on anyone. Sausage-shaped bacteria? What do you call the round ones? The round ones are cocci. The sausage-shaped ones are bacilli. Yeah. Yeah, staph would be a cocci, wouldn't it? Yeah. So they're bacteria. That's, I can't remember what you call those things, with the ears. That's it, yep. The bottom right is cannabis plants. Yeah? Who's got an allotment? It's potatoes. Now, whatever you do, don't eat the fins of that mushroom, the fly gag. Now, if you want to eat the red part, that's fine, you'll hallucinate. But if you eat the white part underneath as well, you'll hallucinate and die. So the top part is hallucinogenic and the white part underneath is poisonous. Or was it the other way around? Anyway, it's a fungus, isn't it? And the chemistry in all of those things is exactly the same. Right? It's the same gene sequences, it's the same gene coding, it's the same ATP, ADP, energy formation. Everything is the same in fungi. We knew it for bacteria and rabbits and potatoes. But about 15 years ago, Sir Paul Nurse, famous British biologist, discovered that the fungi were the same, exactly the same gene regulatory mechanisms as well, which is kind of interesting. That means two things, or one of two things. It means that they were all based on the same basic design, or it means that they all originated from one single last universal common ancestor. So if you want to believe that God designed those, that's one explanation. If you don't want to believe that, then you must believe that they all originated from one single prokaryotic cell. If you want to believe an evolutionary paradigm to explain us, then there is no alternative to the fact that life could only have arisen once, just once, because it's all so closely interrelated. That's somewhat indelicate, this one, but anyway, we'll do it. It's in the Old Testament somewhere, isn't it? Genesis chapter 2, that one, I think. This next one's slightly indelicate. Dad's contribution was 200 million a day. But of course, that could have been on any one of 365 days in the year. And how long is Dad going to be viable for? Should we say 30 years, conservatively? And Mum's contribution, there's a choice of 40,000 cells from Mum's contribution. So that means the probability of you existing from any one of those two cells would be 1 chance in 8.76 times 10 to the 19, which is that number. That's assuming, of course, your mum met your dad. Of course, come to think of it, that assumes your mum existed. Which, of course, meant that your grandmum met your granddad, didn't it? It becomes improbable that your individual consciousness would ever exist. And by comparison, if you want to win the real Millions jackpot, that's your odds of that one. Just a couple of things about you. In your brain, there's 100,000 million nerve cells. Each of these nerve cells has between 1,000 and 10,000 synaptic interconnections per neuron. That makes your brain the most complicated known structure in the cosmos. In your head is the most complicated structure in the universe. So the evidence for all of this means that good science creates a case for design which is utterly overwhelming. Creation has utterly overwhelming scientific evidence. Completely overwhelming. And you present this to people and they say, yeah, but if it wasn't all like that, we'd never know, would we? Let me read that. You've only got 3 minutes left. You can all concentrate for 3 minutes, can't you? Good job they all missed, wasn't it? Or is there something going on here? Because I'm thinking. So I've not been shot. Otherwise I wouldn't be thinking. Can you see each of these fine-tuning parameters is one marksman? They all have to be right. Everyone has to miss. In the case of us existing, everyone has to hit the probability of that happening by chance is not there. And then how do we know this? How do we know anything? The only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Why should the universe be comprehensible by the human mind? And this is a thought that plagued Darwin. He thought he might be completely wrong. Then the horrid doubt where the convictions of man's mind. What Darwin was saying there is that because we evolved from lower animals, we may not be able to depend on our rationality. Maybe we think we're rational, but we're not. So Darwin couldn't even trust his own mind because he believed it evolved from lower animals. And if you want hours of interesting reading on Louise Wintonite, all Charles Darwin's letters are now available online. So what's our view for believing that we're right? Well, God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. Genesis chapter 2. So not only does all this make sense, but if we believe Romans chapter 1, then all of this was made by God, by the same God who made the human mind, and God made the human mind so it was able to comprehend the nature of reality. If Christianity is about anything, it's about truth. I'm only interested in what's true. And this is how we know it's true, because we can think God's thoughts after him. So John Lennox says, we're not talking about blind faith. Faith is based on reason. We do have reasons to believe. And these were just the reasons from science, or a minuscule fraction of the reasons from science. And as Christians, we know all this was done by the Lord Jesus Christ himself. Who's it? You're in charge, Sam. You're in charge. What are we doing now? Is that it? I'll go home and beat me up now. What do you want to do? Do you want to ask questions? Go on, ask some questions. Yeah, questions.